Whitney. Great. So again, welcome to the second and final webinar for Master Your Meal Plan. And if actually if you guys that are in the chat, if you wouldn't mind just confirming that you can see me and hear me okay. I've got a bit of a cold, but apart from that, just be good to confirm that we're all working okay from a technical perspective. So great, thanks, Carol. So we'll get started. So excuse my cold. I'm just checking my notes here. So I guess the first thing is just some housekeeping. So don't be shy. It's really the webinar, the purpose of the webinar and the reason I hold them is because it's the only opportunity that you guys get to interact with me live. Everything else we do is time delay, even if you're leaving comments or whatever. So I really want to encourage you to, this is really your time to ask me questions. It's really the only opportunity that you get in the class to really, interact and have a conversation and a dialogue. So as you think of things, just please write them in the comments and I'll go through. But what I thought I'd do is I'll similar format to last webinar, I'll just go through, start with a bit of a recap of where we're at with the program. And then I've got some questions that have come in via email and just via the comments as well. So I'll go through those and then I'll open it up to live questions. And you're welcome. I really love to hear your feedback on how you found the class. It doesn't have to be a question. If you've got a comment or if there's something you're struggling with or something that you've particularly loved or any, aha moments that you've had with the program. So really, really love to get some dialogue going around the program. So yeah, I'll go through the questions that have come in first, and then I'll open it up to live questions, and we'll just see how long we go with that. And then I'll tell you about a few things that are coming up next. So just starting with the recap. So in the last module, in the last webinar, we kind of focused on the first three modules. I think we're up to which was the 2-minute planning system and formula in module one, template recipes in module two, maximizing flexibility in module three. So for this webinar, I wanted to focus on module four and module five, just because we haven't spoken about them. But of course, if you've got questions on any of the modules or anything to do with meal planning, I'm happy to answer that. Or anything to do with cooking in general, even if it's just something random, like you've got a burning question, this is a great chance to ask me. So just a couple of things on module four and module five. So module four is actually one of the biggest modules that we have in the program. There's a lot of content there because minimizing waste is a massive topic. So it's one of my favorite modules because it's really an opportunity to, save yourself a lot of money, but also you really get the most out of the food that you are buying. So there's a lot of ways we can approach minimizing waste because we can look at and if you go when you go through the module, you'll see, there's a section on buying produce because I don't you'll probably notice yourself if I go to the farmer's market and buy my veggies there, they last way longer than if I go down to my local supermarket and buy them. So buying the right produce, like buying good quality produce, is kind of the first step. How you store that produce is big, and then I look at just kind of take you through just some a heads up on food spoilage and some tips there, just so to get you thinking about what is going to cause your food to go bad. And then following on from that, we look at a bit of preserving, and then we go into the whole other approach, which is so we've got the ingredient approach, or you can approach it from the other end, which is like leftovers. So making the leftovers last as long as possible, finding creative ways to use leftovers, the best way to store them, and all those sorts of things. So it's a meaty module, but it's actually one that can really make a difference to your food dollars and how much you spend and how far the food goes, and also just how much you enjoy what you're eating and stuff. Leftovers can be fun. Then module five, that's the kind of bonus module, and that's all about classic flavor combinations. So this is really kind of part two of the template recipes, and just looking at different approaches to help you kind of come up with your own when you're creating it, when you're making your meal out of a template recipe, to give you some ideas about where to start from so that you don't have to completely invent something new every time you walk into the kitchen, because there's so much knowledge and so many things have been tried throughout the ages, and there's some classics that just work for whatever reason, so there's no need for you to go reinventing the wheel. So that classic flavor combinations is really all about bringing you up to speed, but also getting you to start thinking about noticing, things that you particularly love or not, or things that don't work well for you, so that when you're actually in the kitchen, you've got a place that you're starting from. So that's the two modules. And oh, I should also mention, if you have a look, we've got some bonuses coming up this week. So it's an extra kind of graduation bonuses, but I'll let you discover them on your own. But if you just go to the bonuses tab, they'll be appearing right there. So that's kind of where we're at with the program. So it has gone really quickly. Excuse me, I just have a bit of tea there. And so I'll move on to the questions. So this was some feedback. I wanted to start with this one, which is feedback that came in via email from one of the Master Meal Plan students. I won't name who. And they were kind of struggling a little bit. So they were, and the feedback was, I'm finding the weights module really helpful for tweaking a few things, but I haven't actually felt in the zone to cook an actual template recipe meal yet. And so I thought that was a really interesting comment. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that because it's kind of, I know it can be a bit scary when you're starting out. And if you haven't actually, jumped in and tried to cook something from a template recipe, I really encourage you to actually get in there and do that, because the thing with cooking, it's a practical skill, and the only way you're going to learn, like you can read all the theory you like, read all the cookbooks you like, watch all my videos millions of times if you like, but until you actually get in there and try something for yourself, you're not actually going to get it, kind of thing. So that's just how things are with cooking, but which is kind of good in other ways, because you don't have to read all that theory and do all that other stuff. You can, you can just get in and try things. So really encourage you, if you haven't, don't feel like you need to be in the zone or in this perfect place before you start trying this. What I would encourage you to do is just choose a time where there's less pressure. So if you're cooking for a lot of people, if you can choose a time where you're just cooking for yourself, so maybe, lunch on a weekend or whatever kind of suits your schedule, so you don't have that pressure of, oh, if I screw it up, everyone's going to hate it. And also, when choose a time to kind of start doing this when you're not under time pressure and you're not tired and you're not grumpy. So, if you've had a really bad day at the office, it's probably not, and you come home late and everyone's starving, that's probably not the time to start tackle your first template recipe. But schedule some time, make some time, and really, you'll surprise yourself. Like I'm constantly still surprising myself with, just how good things can taste with just a little bit of effort. So really encourage you to get in there and have a go, and really start before you're ready. Don't feel like you need to have all your ducks lined up before, because you'll never start that way, and then you'll never get any changes. And you'll just go back to the same old frustrations. And I really don't want that to happen. I really want this class to be a springboard for you to kind of venture off into a new world. So it was great to get that feedback. I really, kind of hadn't thought about things from that perspective. So moving on, then we had a question from Bronwyn, and she says, regarding the shelf life of food, do you have any guidelines on how long things last in the fridge? I've been brought up thinking that everything you cook goes off or is full of baddies after a couple of days, but you seem to indicate otherwise. How can I find out, for example, how long is reasonable for cooked bolognese sauce to stay in the fridge? Which, awesome question, Bronwyn. I'm so glad you asked it. So there's a couple of things we need to look at here. So Look, I guess like the typical guidelines that you are given from the, kind of Food and Drug Administration, whoever is setting these guidelines, remember that they need to be very conservative because if someone dies following their guidelines, they'll be sued, they'll feel terrible. That's really, not what anyone wants to happen. So they tend to be very conservative, and that's where this whole, cooked food will only last a few days in the fridge kind of mentality has come from. But because and they also need to take in they need to cater for a big range of safety kind of situations. So, if someone hasn't properly cooked the food or it hasn't been properly chilled, all those things. So they tend to be very conservative. Whereas in real life, in your home, you'll know A, whether you've cooked your food through first. So a bolognese sauce that's been simmering away for hours, that by the time that's finished cooking, there's pretty much no bugs left in it. Whereas a rare steak that you've just seared on the outside, that's a bit more high risk. So that's kind of one of the first things you need to think about. The second thing you need to think about is, did I chill this properly and quickly? So was it left sitting around for 6 hours before I put it in the out on the counter before I put it in the fridge? Or was it, pretty much after dinner we cleaned up, I put it in the fridge then. So if it's that it's been cooked properly for starters and then chilled promptly, so kind of within 2 to 3 hours, then that it's pretty safe to begin with. And that really makes a difference. Like the amount of any bugs that are in something at the beginning when it goes into the fridge will determine how long it's going to last in the fridge. So essentially, that's kind of the best way to think about it. So if you have done those first both of those things to begin with, then for me, I often, on a regular basis, will keep stews, curries, bolognese sauce, meatballs, that sort of thing, for at least a week in my fridge. But I, on the other, the third piece to think about is your fridge at the correct temperature? So for in Australia, that's in Celsius, that's less than 4 degrees Celsius, but in Fahrenheit, it's I think less than 39 or 30, around 39 Fahrenheit. So the third piece to it is if your fridge is a bit dodgy, then I'd be inclined to be more conservative. But if your fridge is relatively new, it's keeps things chilled, then you're fine. You don't have to go out and buy a fridge thermometer. You'll know whether your fridge is working as it should or not. So when you've got those three things, when you know those two things, and if they're all okay, then I often keep leftovers for at least a week, often 2 weeks, sometimes a little bit beyond 2 weeks. And the thing that I really look out for is before I eat something, if it's been in there and I can't remember how long it's been in the fridge for, I smell it to make sure it smells okay. If it smells dodgy, definitely throw it. The second thing is I really look closely to see if there's any mold growth because molds are just the most hardy of all the microorganisms. So they're able to grow in the kind of coldest temperatures and the lowest, in the most inhospitable climates kind of thing. So they're the first things that are going to start growing in your food, which is kind of a nice indicator. Have a look if there's any mold, of course, ditch it. But if there's no mold and it smells good, then I will use it. But I won't, if something's a bit, and I'm not sure how old it is, I definitely won't just eat it cold straight from the fridge. I'll make sure that I heat it up just as an extra insurance policy so that any bugs that are in there will get killed off. So I'll make sure I bring it up to a proper boil and like simmer it for a good 5 to 10 minutes just to make sure it's okay before I eat it. So that's a pretty long-winded answer on food safety, but it is important. And I think the thing with it is it's important to trust your gut. And if you don't feel comfortable eating something, if you're worried about it's going to stress you out, it's not worth it. Like don't do it, even if there's no mold on it or whatever. But if you do feel comfortable and you feel like it's okay, then go for it. So it's all about kind of trusting your instincts on that one that does come into it because it's not worth causing extra stress in your life. Okay, so that was a bit of a long one. Then moving on, this was actually a comment that came in from Nick on the minimizing waste module, and I'd kind of put a call out there for, is there any ingredients that you struggle with, or do you have any suggestions that work well for you when it comes to keeping, making ingredients and leftovers last? And Nick had a brilliant idea, so I thought I'd share it with you because I have similar problems. He says, I find storing avocados annoying. I always forget them and they go to waste, which is a big problem in my house as well. So she says, what I do now is she spreads the avocado on bread to make sandwiches for the children and then freezes them as healthy snacks, which I thought was really clever. So I just, pardon me, I thought I'd put that one out there for everyone in case you guys didn't see that comment. Okay, then moving on. There's a comment here from Katrina on reinventing leftovers. And okay, so Katrina writes, the section on reinventing leftovers was phenomenally enlightening to me. I grew up on a fairly steady diet of casseroles, which meant leftovers were hard to reinvent. I was not even aware that people did this until many years after I left home, which I thought was pretty funny. Even now, when there are two or three separate dishes to a meal, my husband and I will usually take the leftovers and just recreate the same meal if it was tasty enough the first time, right? Which makes sense, and that's perfectly fine. So, this is what I wanted to talk to you about that. Then Katrina asks, Jules, have you ever thought of making some kind of challenge or a mini course out of this? Or totally participate in something like that. So cook up a big batch of protein X, veg Y, veg legume Z at the start of the week and just use it up in various ways as the week goes on. So loved this comment. And we actually have a class already on that. Kind of not so much on reinventing leftovers, but it really does focus on cooking up big batches of different things and then using them in different ways. So the program's called The Weekend Cook, and it's already online for you to access. So go in there, and that's really, it's all about mise en place. It's all about, ways to cook up, different proteins, different veg, different legumes, different things. And then also, if you look on the main page, so there's a recipe of how to cook the whatever ingredient, and then there's also four or five suggestions of how to use that ingredient, so different ways that you can use it in. And some of them are just suggestions that are written there on that first page, but then others are actually links to recipes on the Stonetip Virtual Cookery School. So wanted to just bring your attention to that class. It's a really great kind of follow-up class to Master Your Meal Plan because it does kind of go really deep on the mise en place thing, and I think it kind of ties in nicely with the making leftovers last as well. And just wanted to give you guys a heads up that I am planning on kind of doing a bit of a revamp of that program later in the year. So we'll be looking at going even deeper and maybe including, not really sure yet, but I'll watch this space for more details about that one. Okay, so next one was from Nick again, just on digital scales. She says, I've been meaning to get some digital scales for a while. Heard you banging on about them in the webinar, but you can get them for about $30. Is there a brand I should be looking for, or what should I look for in buying digital scales, features, etc.? So I did write back to Nick, but just wanted to, in case anyone else heard the last webinar and was interested in investing in digital scales, if I've finally convinced you that they're worth it. There's the thing that I really look for is just clean ability. Simple design so that it's easy to wipe down. And I've had a couple of sets of kitchen scales in my career. I bought them for friends and for my mom. And I've usually gone with a brand called Salto, but any kind of kitchen scale will be fine. You just look for something that's got a pretty simple design so that you can keep it clean is really the biggest biggest thing. And then the other thing to look out for is if you are cooking, if you're using metric and imperial, you can get some that will measure. You can switch between grams and ounces, or grams and ounces. So that if you think that might be a useful feature to you, kind of keep an eye out for that. But apart from that, they're pretty, the more you really just need something basic, and that will do. And the other thing to look out for is to make sure you can tear it so that you're making a cake, you can weigh your butter in, and then into the bowl, just press zero, and then weigh your flour in or whatever ingredients in. It just makes it really quick and really easy. Okay, so moving on. Then there was a question from Angela on lovely lentils, which the lovely lentils recipe. And she writes, Jules, when you cook up a big batch on the weekend, how much do you tend to cook? Like just doubles. And the answer was just really simple. So I actually just use the 500 grams, which is about a pound, which is that's the size of the packet that they come in over here. So I just usually eat them over a week or a week and a half kind of thing. But you're welcome to double those recipes. You can welcome to double. I haven't actually done myself a lot, but I know other people who do it, is that they're great for freezing. And they kind of freeze like frozen peas. So in a pan, they'll only take a couple of minutes to defrost because they're at, tiny little pieces. So if you do cook up too many and your little lentils gross as you are, just pop them in the freezer in individual bags or just in a Ziploc bag, and you'll be good to go. All by email. So thank you for sending those through, Carl. There's a couple of things I just wanted to kind of talk, kind of questions answered, but also, yeah, some just suggestions that you've raised that I thought would be good to share with the whole group on the webinar. So Carol writes, what about when and how to preserve? Oh, yeah, this is a preserved food you know is about to go to waste. So it's a topic that's close to my package of sliced shiitakes into the freezer when it looks like they're about to get sad. And I don't know, and I know I won't use them in time. I think I've washed fresh spinach and kale. What can you do that with? If you have a head of cod right in the time, can you chop it up now and throw it in the freezer? Recognize that they probably won't last as long as something commercial when you can buy yourself a few days or weeks. So I haven't read that very smoothly. So pretty much my philosophy is if something's going off, you tend to freeze it. And really, if it's going to go off anyway, you don't have anything to lose by just chucking it in the freezer. But the general rule of thumb is that the higher moisture content something is, the more damaging the freezing process will be. So like a bunch of kale, if you pop that in the freezer in a plastic bag, it's fairly high moisture, so it is going to wilt. But you're going to cook it anyway probably and wilt it then. So it's most things will surprise you, and they'll turn out okay. Garlic and onions tend to be, oh, onions actually can be okay, but garlic tends to go a bit funny in the freezer, so I don't tend to freeze that. But yeah, herbs like drier herbs, so like rosemary, thyme, curry leaves, bay leaves, they're all awesome in the freezer. Fresh herbs, you've got the wilting thing, but that can be not such a bad thing, as it means that your bunch of basil is going to go off, or it saves it. The only trick with, I think, with freezing things, bits and pieces like that, Carol, is just to make sure that you have a bit of a mental check-in, that you remember to look in your freezer before you go shopping, so that you're not building up this big stockpile of bits and pieces of vegetables that end up causing you grief and causing you to throw them out later. But that was a great question. And then Carol also asked along the same lines, when can you use something a little yucky? So shriveled but not yet moldy lemon cut up inside a roast chicken, or sliced on top of baked fish, etc. And really, that's a great question, Carol. It's really up to you. So, and like your kind of tolerance for things are, as you say, a little bit yucky. So if something's, completely moldy, I usually forget about it. But if I've got, say, a piece of cheese, it's got a little bit of mold growing on one side, I'll usually, just chop that off and still use the hunk of cheese. It's really a kind of a personal preference thing. But of course, if something is a little bit yucky, if you're going to be cooking it rather than eating it fresh, then it's way more likely to be safe. But a thing to keep in mind is that some molds can have like kind of not so nice chemicals coming. I don't want to kind of scare you on that, but if you ever get moldy peanuts, definitely a no-go. And green potatoes, definitely a no-go with that one. And if you are going to be cooking it, it's way more likely to be safe than if you're just going to eat it raw. Kind of hard to give a guideline on the scale of icky. Trust your gut. If it feels really icky and you don't want to touch it, then I wouldn't eat. I'd throw it out. But if my carrots are a little bit shriveled, give them a wash. And give them a scrub, and I'd still use them. Same with slightly wilted veg that are not super anal about that sort of stuff, for want of a better word. Okay, so we've been going for half an hour, just going through my questions. Okay. Excuse me, having some tea. Okay, so another one from Carol, and she says this is just a general thing. There are lots of great lessons inside your classes. Oh, this is more of a comment from Carol, a suggestion. There are lots of great lessons inside your classes that it would be great to access outside the class, or to be able to find in another way. So, for example, the kitchen tour, the pantry tour, and they're from Solve Your Dinner Dilemma. Food storage, etc. So if you pull those out into their own mini classes, and they would be available even if someone didn't do a particular master class or a particular in-depth class, which awesome suggestion, Carol. A bit of great minds thinking alike here. So what I've actually started doing this year is building two streams. There's so if you look in the navigation menu on the Stone Soup Virtual Cookery School site, next to the short classes, there's a pull-down menu that says skills and another one that says techniques. And so they're actually two streams that I'm working on, just adding to, on a regular basis. So if there is that, there's just something to check out, and you'll get an email, a weekly email about new things that I put up on there. But so far we've got things like ingredient substitution, habit change, seasoning, cooking lunches, mise en place, and then under the techniques we've got stir frying, one pot meals and herbs. So that's like a place that I've actually already started. So things I just wanted to bring everyone's attention to that. So it's kind of another way to access the material in the classes without going into the class. So it's kind of like if you just want to dip in and learn a new quick skill or a new technique, that's a great place to start without having to dig through a whole program on something. So that is already there, and it's a work in progress. So I'm actually, adding to that as we go along. So great suggestion, Carol. Okay, almost through, and where is that actually? Oh, there's a question that came in by email, and I can't remember who this was from, but they said they were really enjoying the class, which was awesome. And that they were able to download the audio for each audio lessons for each module, which is great. But the question was, how do they download the written lessons? And the answer to that is, at the moment, there's you'd have to copy and paste from the website to download or to save the written lessons. But one of your bonuses is going to be an ebook for the whole class, so a PDF that has all the written lessons and links to all the videos. It has all the recipes, pretty much everything except the fun sheets from the class. So watch your email inbox, because you will be getting that, and then you'll be able to save all the written lessons and everything all in the one document. So it'll save you having to copy and paste and do all sorts of things. Okay. And okay, last one here from Mary. So she says, Mary writes, my husband likes to cook more rather than just enough for the meal, so we always end up with lots of leftovers. At least that saves us money for lunches, because we always have something to take from home. But I do get tired of eating the same thing, so look forward to trying your ideas in the module on minimizing waste. So yeah, just wanted to raise that. If you are someone that does have tends to generate lots of leftovers, really encourage you to check out the minimizing waste module. And specifically, there's a lesson in there on 11 tips for reinventing leftovers. So it's actually a lot that you can do with leftovers. It's kind of, a whole new whole section of creativity that you can play. So I'll just refer you to that if you have any questions on leftovers. Great. So, okay, so now just that's all I had on the questions that have come in by email. So I'll just open it up to people that are actually online, and if you have any questions, I'll just have a look here in the chat and see if anything's come in. So Carol's writes, need to know more about freezing avocados sliced whole wrapped. Great question, Carol. I think the less surface area you have exposed, the less browning there's going to be. So if you've got half an avocado, if you leave the stone in, that's the best thing. Just pop it in a Ziploc bag, or wrap it up in. Ziploc bags are pretty good, because they tend to be a bit thicker. If you just wrap it in cling film, that to not ha it's doesn't have the barrier properties that a thicker plastic will have, so you can get freezer burn if you just wrap it in cling film. So, or you could put it in a container, airtight container. But yeah, the bigger would be better. But then, of course, you can always use Nick's idea of making sandwiches, or using it in some other way. So you can make up a little batch of guacamole if you wanted to, and freeze that. Yeah, I actually haven't had a lot of experience with freezing avocado, so yeah, that's that. But that's where I would start. Like, the kind of bigger would be less damaging. Okay, so got a question that's come in from Nick. Any tips for cooking with tougher herbs? For example, rosemary, that have lovely flavor but are texturally not nice to eat. Do you pull it out after cooking, or chop it really finely? Excellent question, Nick. Yay. So I love rosemary. It's one of my favorites, and I also love thyme. So kind of two approaches. If it's a dish that I'm cooking, like a slow-cooked stew, or something that's going to be cooking for quite a lot of time with liquid, I tend to just, throw the whole sprig of rosemary in, and then I find that the leaves do cook down in the time so that you don't get that yuckiness to eat them. So yeah, that's for like that type of dish. But it's always important to remember to pull the stalk out before you serve, because that's definitely not nice to eat. But if it's something that you're going to be cooking that's not going to be cooking for as long, yeah, you're right. You can do either. It's like up to you. You can either just pull it out after cooking and just just throw away the whole stalk. And you'll know like the flavor has been infused into your sauce or whatever. Or the other approach is to chop it really finely, as you've suggested. So you're answering your own question here, Nico. Such a very, very good. The other thing I like to think about doing is, particularly for sage and things like that, is sometimes, if I'm getting a bit fancy, just frying them in a little bit of oil or butter. That can make them all crispy, and it actually makes them a really nice texture. And then you can use that kind of to sprinkle on top, and that gives you an interesting highlight. So that's kind of the way I approach the woodier herbs. Of course, bay leaves, they're pretty much, use them to infuse in the sauce and then get rid of them. But I guess the other approach you could take is, yeah, like when I'm using kaffir lime leaves for, kind of Asian dishes, I'll sometimes just chop, or lemongrass, just make sure I chop it up really, really finely, and then it kind of gets distributed throughout the dish and it's easy to eat. Whereas if you have big chunks of lime leaves or big chunks of lemongrass, it can be not so nice. So long answer to your question. And Carol's written stuff. There we go. She browns them in a pan with garlic and sun-dried tomatoes. So there you go. Great minds think alike, Carol. Great. So do you guys have any more questions or anything, comments you'd like to make on the class or anything else you'd like me to talk about this morning or this evening, for depending on where you are in the world? Okay, this is a great question for Nick. So Nick writes, "I've been cooking with your recipes for so long now that if I see other recipes with lots of ingredients, I'm immediately put off. Yay, Nick, I've converted you." And interestingly, Nick, like since I've been cooking with five ingredients, when I am following someone else's recipe, it's very like I usually do that on the weekends if I want to cook something a bit fancier, and I really struggle to cook and use all the ingredients that are in other people's recipes too. So I'm definitely with you on that. And so, do you have any tips for converting recipes to the stone soup way? How do you decide which are the most important ingredients? That's an excellent question. I probably could like run a whole class on this. So I guess the first thing I do is I look for stuff that's doubled up. So often you'll find, someone will use two or three different types of herbs. So they might use mint, coriander, parsley. Sometimes you'll even see people using basil as well. So then I'll look at that and I go, well, do I really need three or four herbs? No. So I'll probably just choose one herb to ingredients that have similar functions. I usually just go for one. So with spices, that can be a little, I might look at it and go, well, it's Indian, I might just use one spice blend instead of using a combination of spices. So that's kind of the first, and that's the easy pruning to do, is any ingredients that have a similar function or a similar, like they kind of look, they're kind of a similar type of ingredient. If there's been multiple of those used in the recipe, that's kind of the first thing I look to prune. What else do I do? And then I guess so kind of start from that end. And the other way is to start from the end up looking at, well, really what's the most important ingredients in here. So if it's, you know, a chicken dish, obviously like the chicken's really important. So yeah, that stays in, but what happens after, you know, if there's, you know, four or five ingredients that go in to make the sauce, I kind of look in and I'll question, do I need all of those ingredients in my sauce, or can I chop some out to make it a bit easier? Another thing I often do is, particularly from when I was writing 5 Ingredients, 10 Minutes, that book, because, you know, time was such a big focus, and it always, you know, so many recipes will start with, you know, softening an onion or browning an onion. And that you usually, that'll take 10 minutes on its own. So I often, kind of those things that are, those ingredients that are adding like layers of flavour, I often look at stripping those out. So softening an onion, I'll often just ditch that to begin with. And then if I think it needs some onioniness at the end, you can always add in some chives, you know, chopped chives, or, yeah, that's good. The chives are usually my favourite. Sometimes I have some of those sliced fried shallots from the Asian grocery store. You can just add them in at the end. That's sometimes a good trick for saving time with onions. What else do I do when I'm simplifying recipes? Yeah, it's really just asking, yeah, what's the like kind of looking through the ingredient list and looking at each ingredient and just asking yourself, like, what's the function of this? Is it just providing an extra layer of flavor, or is this really, you know, kind of the star of the show? So without having a, wish I had a cookbook here that I could just open up and kind of take you through a recipe. Actually, I might just go grab a magazine. So back again. great. So this is Australian Gourmet Traveller magazine. It's actually out of the loo. So we kind of have a magazine rack here in our loo. It's probably a bit more information than you need. But this is like a magazine I've been subscribing to for years. It's really, you know, I love their photography. They do a great job. Rolls Royce, and they think about getting me the most amazing meal at the end rather than thinking about simplicity and timing, although they do have a little section on quick cooking each month. Most of the stuff, it's like it's fancy, it's complicated, but you can get some really great ideas from it. But anyway, so for a spiced pumpkin soup, and I actually made this on the weekend, so I'll just read you through the ingredient list. It's like 2 butternut pumpkins or butternut squash for people that don't eat pumpkin. And they've got half a teaspoon each of smoked paprika, ground cumin, 1 teaspoon of ground chili, finely grated rind and juice of 1 lemon, 110 mils of olive oil, 2 garlic, a Spanish onion, 5 cups of chicken stock, sherry vinegar, a Granny Smith apple, radicchio leaves, parsley, and then roasted pepitas or sunflower seeds. So we've got like 16 ingredients there just for a pumpkin soup. So they are actually serving their pumpkin soup. It does look very pretty with the radicchio and apple on top. So when I made my pumpkin soup on Saturday night, first thing I did was completely forget about the salad. And I also, because I was just like, you know, salad on top of soup's a bit weird to begin with, but that immediately cut out like 4 or 5 ingredients. Using garlic and onion. So I decided that for mine, I actually ended up using leeks for my soup, but, you know, they're kind of in that family, and I just used that, the one ingredient, leek, rather than using, because, you know, the allium, I think they're called alliums, but those, you know, oniony kind of family things, they add different flavours, but, you know, they kind of do the same thing. So that's one thing I chopped out. So that's like another 2 ingredients I've saved. So I ended up using butternut pumpkin, leeks. Instead of olive oil, I used butter. Then I had chicken stock. And okay, and this is kind of a tricky one that I did. So they're using sherry vinegar and lemon juice to give some acidity. So rather than use either of those, I actually served my soup with sour cream on top. So that was giving the acidity. So my soup had five ingredients. It was delicious. I loved it, but it didn't look that fancy. But that's kind of, that's a real life example. And I decided to skip the spices. That was just a personal choice. I wasn't really in the mood for spices, but I could have chosen to use, like they've used four different spices. I could have chosen to use just any one of those. So paprika, cumin, coriander, or I mean, with spices, sometimes you just, you can use them all. It's really up to you and how you're feeling. I skip the chili. So there you go. It was a bit of fun. Thanks for inspiring that, Nick. So that's an example of how I do it. And maybe it's just, something that we could look at on a more regular basis. I think I did write a blog post years ago about that. So I should dig it up and I'll put a link to that blog post underneath the webinar. I'll just write myself a little note because I'm pretty sure I did write something about how I go about simplifying recipes. It might be a bit more coherent than my rambling just then. So converting. Great. Okay. And then just looking, and Carol has a question, one really specific question. We love those. How do you use porcini mushrooms? I don't remember what recipe you suggested them. Great question, Carol. I love porcini mushrooms, but they do tend to be really expensive, and they're actually kind of hard to come by in Australia because they're not native. They're not kind of grown in Australia, so they tend to be imported from Italy. So usually they are super expensive. So they you can in certainly in Europe, and I think I've even seen them when I was living in California for sale as fresh mushrooms. So in that case, mushroom recipes, like just you can use them any way you'd use normal mushrooms. So, sauteing them, pan frying them, roasting them, any of those kind of techniques work really well for mushrooms. Let me think. But yeah, so the porcini mushrooms that you get in Australia usually come in two ways. So they're either finely sliced and they're dried, so you get like kind of tiny little slices of mushroom, or a cheaper way to buy that is they actually come powdered, where they've just dried the mushrooms and then powdered them up. So they have that really beautiful, intense, porcini mushroom flavour, which I absolutely love. So when I'm using them in Australia, and I can't remember the last time I used them actually. First thing I usually do is soak the. I tend to. I haven't really used the mushroom powder, so that you can just add a little. What I would do with that is, if I was cooking another mushroom dish, I'd just add in a couple of teaspoons of the porcini powder when I was sauteing the mushrooms or when I was roasting them or if I was making a soup. Just when I added the stock, and it's like a little boost of mushroomy goodness. So it kind of turbocharges your mushroom flavor, if you will. So that's kind of it for the powder. But then for the dried mushrooms, the best way I find is to rehydrate them. And so just put them in a little bowl and cover them with some boiling water and just let them sit for 5 to 10 minutes. A little bit longer is not going to hurt. It actually be good and let them soften, and then I usually finely chop them and then add them in with other mushrooms when I'm cooking them. And the soaking liquid that you use will be super intensely flavored as well, so make sure you pour that in. Even if you're just sauteing it, just pour it in at the end and let that cook through with the mushrooms, and they are yummy, and you're actually making me feel like making some mushroom soup now. So that's a great question. And the specific questions are great here as well as more general stuff. Okay, great. Okay, so Nick's got another question. Gosh, we're doing well today. With your brownie recipe, you melt the butter instead of softening it. Can that be done with cakes as well? That's an awesome question, Nick. So Okay, so when you're baking, the thing to think about is looking at your recipe and just figuring out where the leavening is going to come from. So the kind of baked goods, you want them to have some sort of lightness to them. So brownies, not so much. They tend to be, you want them fairly dense and squidgy. So I can't even remember if I use baking powder in my brownies or not. But anyway, so back to leavening. So there's a few different ways that you can, and leavening is just a way of saying, kind of getting air into the mixture. So there's a few different ways you can do that. Adding baking powder will do that. So that's like a really reliable, easy way. Any recipe you often see baked good recipes where you separate the egg yolks and the whites and you beat the egg whites. And so the air in the egg white is providing your leavening. So that's kind of the second technique. And then another technique is which is used predominantly for making cookies. So we did this a lot when I was working at Arnott's, is to cream, you'll see it says to cream the butter and sugar, where you're actually whipping the butter and sugar. And you know how the butter and sugar, when you whip it, it kind of goes lighter in color. So that's actually air that's being trapped in there, similar to the egg white thing, but not as not as obvious and not as intense as the egg white thing, but that is providing some air so that when it goes into the oven, the air expands and that causes your baked goods to rise and be all light and lovely. So yeah, back to your question, Nick. Could you melt the butter with cakes? Yeah, you can absolutely, but if that recipe, all you're doing for leavening is creaming the butter and sugar, if you melt the butter and just mix it through all the other ingredients, your cake's going to end up quite dense and flat. But if your cake is creaming butter sugar and it also has some baking powder added to it, I'd just add a little bit more baking powder and that will usually do the job. So that's a kind of long answer to a short question, is that you can do that, and it's really kind of a trying, suck it and see kind of thing. Okay, I've got another baking question from Nick. This is great. What's the difference between using self-raising flour and plain flour with baking powder? So that's a really cool question as well. So just to make this a bit more international, so I can't remember off the top of my head. So in Australia, we have like two types of baked flour that we bake with, as Nick mentioned, self-raising flour and plain flour. In the US, plain flour is called all-purpose flour, and I think self-raising flour is called self-raising flour. But anyway, whatever it's called, all-purpose flour is just the flour, so it's doesn't have any leavening agents added to it, and by leavening agents I mean baking powder or baking soda or sodium bicarbonate. Whereas self-raising flour actually has baking powder included, kind of pre-mixed into it, so that you don't have to add baking powder separately. So it's just like a convenience thing, really. So I'm not cooking with flour a lot these days, actually, at all, but I tend to just keep plain flour and baking powder in the house. And if I've got a recipe that calls for self-raising flour, I'll just add in my own baking powder. So the kind of rule of thumb is for 1 cup of flour, which is about 150 grams, which is about 5 ounces, I'm thinking off the top of my head here, you use 2 kind of level teaspoons of baking powder. And just mix that through the plain flour or the all-purpose flour, and then you have instant self-raising flour. So it saves you keeping an extra ingredient. It's an extra step when you're baking, but it saves you having to worry about it. So you'll notice in some of my recipes, I use self-raising flour in the recipe, and was just when I was really conscious of trying to keep things, five ingredients, and being very diligent about that five ingredient limit. So please, it is really interchangeable. And in some ways, adding the baking powder separately can be a better thing because you can make sure that your baking powder is really fresh because it does go off over time and lose its potency. So that's it. I love baking questions. I probably should another thing to speak about. So because that can be a little bit confusing as well, particularly when you know an international group of bakers. So there's baking powder, baking soda, which they're the same thing. So the baking soda is just tends to be used in the US as the name, but in Australia we call it baking powder. And then the other thing is sodium bicarbonate or bicarb soda, and it has other names as well. So the baking powder or the baking soda, it's different in that it contains a mixture of chemicals. So it's actually, how can I say simply? So it's actually got a balance between acid and it's pH neutral, basically. So it'll work in any recipe on its own. It just needs a bit of water to a bit of liquid to get it going, and then it'll do its thing and produce carbon dioxide, which causes the leavening, you know, in the oven when the baked good goes in and the carbon dioxide expands with the heat from the oven. So that's my go-to is baking powder. I just keep that in the in the cupboard because it's you can use it anywhere. Bicarbonate of soda or bicarb soda, on the other hand, is just one chemical. So it's actually an alkaline, and it actually needs some sort of acid ingredient in your batter or whatever you're baking to activate it to cause the carbon dioxide to happen. So it's a little bit, it's more simple. And the risk with using bicarbonate soda is that if you don't have enough acid in your recipe, then it won't be neutralized at the end of the baking process, and your actual baked good can have a kind of soapy flavor that comes from it. So rule of thumb, just stick with baking powder or baking soda, and just forget about bicarb, although it is very good for cleaning and other purposes as well. So you know, if you want to keep it in the house, that's fine, but just as a rule of thumb for baking. And usually in a recipe, most recipes these days I see, you know, most people just use baking powder. Sometimes you'll see a combination of using baking powder and baking soda. I mean, using baking powder or / baking soda plus sodium bicarbonate. I actually have a chocolate chip cookie recipe, and for some reason, I've tried it with just baking powder and it isn't quite as good, so I've left that in. But nine times out of ten, you know, just use baking powder, you'll be fine. And if it doesn't rise quite as much as you'd like, just next time tweak your recipe, add an extra half teaspoon or an extra teaspoon, and you'll get there. So there we go. So that was a lot of baking talk. Oh, hi, Marla. Actually, I should have mentioned, if anyone else has joined us, please say hello in the chat so I know that you're out there and I can say hello to you. Even if you don't have a question, just, you know, it's nice to know who's around. So Marla's got a great question. Can you speak about when to actually add herbs to cooking? While we were talking herbs before, that's a great one. So fresh herbs and dried, she says. So I'll tackle, let's see. So we'll talk about, I kind of like to think of herbs in two categories, and then go into this. There's actually under the skills or the technique section, there's a cooking with herbs section. So I recommend having a look at that after this webinar, but I'll just answer your question anyway. When I'm adding herbs to cooking, my rule of thumb is that fresh herbs I usually add at the end, and your woody herbs. But what I mean by fresh herbs, it's things like the leafy herbs. So stuff that's going to wilt if you don't keep it in water. So basil, coriander or cilantro, parsley, chervil. Kind of all those leafy herbs. I tend to add them at the end of cooking, and the reason for that is They wilt when you add them at the beginning with the heat, and their flavors tend to be more delicate. So that if you add them at the beginning, and particularly I find this with basil, its flavors really diminished, and you kind of really don't get a lot out of it. So if it's in a sauce, like you struggle to taste the basil. Whereas if you're making a Thai curry and you add the basil at the very end, sprinkle it on top. You'll get that lovely fresh basilness. You'll also get the appearance of the basil, which makes the dish look more appetizing and more healthy and more fragrant. So yeah, fresh herbs, rule of thumb is I tend to add them at the end, usually sprinkling on top, sometimes stirring through, but yeah, that's kind of my preference. Whereas the woody herbs, so that's things like that we were talking about before that can have a not so nice texture, so stuff like rosemary, thyme, sage, can't think of anything off the top of my head now. I tend to cook them, put them in at the beginning and let them cook in. So, and their flavour tends to be, if you think about it, rosemary, it's very pungent, it's very strong, same with sage. So I tend to cook them, put them in at the beginning and let them cook in with the sauce or whatever it is that I'm cooking. Or even, we did some veal cutlets on the barbecue on the weekend, which were really lovely. And I just got some sage, like oiled them and got some sage leaves and stuck them on the outside of the meat. And so they kind of were a little barrier, and they cooked with the barbecue and went all smoky and lovely. So yeah, that's the rule of thumb. Dried herbs, simple answer. Woody herbs in at the beginning, fresh herbs in at the end. But as we mentioned before, sometimes it's nice to just brown a little butter and fry the woody herbs pardon me, in the butter just to make them go crispy, and then serve them on top of your dish. That can be a really lovely kind of thing to do, but it's not something I do very often. It's a bit, kind of more fancy and advanced. And then Marla, you've also asked about dried herbs, and so it can be a bit controversial here. My rule of thumb is I tend not to use dried herbs, because there's two exceptions to that. And the reason is just I find that, they all kind of, my mum used to cook with dried herbs, and they all kind of smell the same, and it kind of smells like dust. So I don't get a lot of flavor and fragrance from them as opposed to fresh herbs. And I'm really lucky, where I live I have my little veggie garden, and herbs are one thing that I have lots of success with growing. So I have access to fresh herbs. So if you don't have access to fresh herbs, then I would think about using dried herbs for this from the supermarket. But a lot of times you're wasting your money, I think. But there are two exceptions, and that is dried oregano and dried mint. So dried oregano tends to be used in Mediterranean cooking, and it's actually, when it's dried, it kind of, I treat it like a woody herb. So I add it at the beginning of cooking. So when I'm cooking, a tomato sauce or a bolognese sauce or something, or tomato sauce to go on pizza kind of thing, I would add the dried oregano at the beginning, and that allows it to rehydrate and the flavors from the dried oregano to go through. But if I was using fresh oregano, I'd probably tend to sprinkle that on my pizza topping, just before I popped it in the oven kind of thing. So the other exception to my dried herb rule is dried mint, which is something that's used a lot in kind of Middle Eastern cooking, and it's similar to fresh mint, but it has this like intensity about it, and it tends to be, again, used. Actually, it can be used either. Like you can stir it through. One of the most common ways to use dried mint is to stir it through yogurt and use that minted yogurt as a sauce in different Middle Eastern dishes. But you can also add the dried mint into things when you're cooking from the beginning. So there we go. That's my world of fresh and dried herbs. Nick says a lazy Susan is great for storing spices and dried herbs in your pantry. That's very cute. I actually have a box, a big wooden box that I can pull out and put on the countertop so I can go through it. But whatever storage system works for you. Wow, so we've been going for an hour and 5 minutes, and I don't think I've spoken this much in a long time. My jaw's getting sore. So does anyone have any more questions? It's been heaps of fun. I really enjoy, kind of talking about this stuff. So yeah, like I'm happy for more questions, but if not, it might be a good time to think about wrapping up. So if you do have any more questions, just drop them in the chat. But I might move on to my kind of up next section. There's a few things I wanted to mention. So basically, master your meal plan is pretty much we've gone through the whole module. You've got all the material at your fingertips, but remember you have access to the material for as long as you've signed up for. So pretty much most of you will have at least another 11 months to go with it. So so coming up next, there's some graduation bonus. So keep an eye out for them, and they'll be appearing. I'll email you about them, but they'll be appearing. They'll be available from the bonuses page of part of the class. Something that's really super important to me is you'll also receive an email with a link to a survey I've created for the class. So really, really encourage you to jump in there. There's a few questions, but I really, it'll make a world of difference to me just to get your feedback on how you found things. There's opportunity for you to really, share your thoughts. And I'm really, the good, the bad, the ugly. I really would love to hear how you found the class, and particularly, any suggestions that you have, or things that you've struggled with, or any ideas that you have about making the class better. Because, I love this business. I love doing what I'm doing, and I'm always on the lookout for ways to make things better. And one of the things I'm actually doing a course on online marketing at the moment. One of the things I talk about there is like the curse of knowledge, which is what I have, because I know the Stonesick Virtual Capri School inside out, so I created it. Of course I do, but that knowledge that I have can actually be a curse, because it's hard for me to actually see what life's like, or how what doing a class is like when you're coming into it fresh and you don't know anything about the topic, or you know a little bit about the topic but you don't know that much. So really encourage you to complete the survey for me. It makes a world of difference. I'll be reading all of the answers, and yeah, it's like a way that we can kind of grow together and make the Stonesick Virtual Cookery School even more helpful for you. So and there's a little surprise bonus if for those people who do, a bit of a bribe for people that do complete that survey. So yeah, please do that when you get the email, and I'll put a link up maybe on module 5, or I'll put a couple of links to the survey as well. So if you do think about it at other times and you want to just go in, and if you want to answer the survey, if you think of something else and you want to answer the survey a couple of times, you can always just go in and answer, put a, just skip the questions you don't want to add anything else to, but include extra comments, whatever works for you. Really try to make it as user-friendly as possible. Okay. Oh yeah, so I mentioned that the class ebook will be available soon, so you'll get an email about that. It'll be available on the bonuses page. Oh, the recipe index, I've updated that now, so all the recipes for the class are on the one page, and they're separated out into different categories, so it makes a bit more sense. So you'll be able to hopefully find what you're looking for a bit easier. There's actually some bonus recipes that are going to be available this week, or I might have already made them available. So they're included in the recipe index as well. So there's about of the template recipes, I think we're up to about, it must be getting close to 70 template recipes, which is huge. And just a tip, a navigation thing. So if you do log on and you just want to access the template recipes, I've put a link under the, let's see what tab code. So if you just look at the tab that says recipes, if you pull that pull down menu down and scroll down, there's actually a template recipes section close to the bottom. So if you click on that, that'll take you straight to the template recipe index. And oh, and one last thing, maternity leave. I was a little bit nervous about scheduling this webinar. this week, since I've only got 2.5 weeks to go. So, if you do, I'll let you guys know when the baby comes. But yeah, so there'll be a few weeks where I'm probably not so accessible, but I'll definitely let you know, and when back on board, you'll know about that as well. So yeah, thank you everyone. A little bit scared about it, just trying not to think about it too much. So yeah, thanks for everyone who's joined us live today. That's really awesome. I really appreciate your questions and your comments. It's been some awesome interaction. I think this is the best webinar we've had for ages. And if you're listening to this on the recording, thank you as well for listening. And hopefully next time you'll be able to join us live, because it is more fun. So with that, I'll sign out, and yeah, hope to see you soon. And of course, if you've got any follow-up stuff, just I'm always available on email, and I do get all the comments. Any comments you leave on anywhere on the site, I get an email with those comments, so I always see them and I try and answer them as soon as I can.